Okay, good morning and welcome to the Philadelphia Association known as United Lodge of Theosophists. And rather than paraphrase our Declaration of Purposes, I'd love to read it with you because it's quite a beautiful thing. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions of differences or of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. The number of lodges around the world that are governed only by this declaration are on the pamphlet, and the periodical also has a philosophical excerpt to be read and a schedule of activities. Here in Philadelphia, all those souls associated with the cause volunteer by donations of time, service, and money to keep the building open and to keep the programs going so that the public has a way to contact the ideas of the philosophy. On Sunday mornings through the month of April, the topic under consideration from a variety of different viewpoints is the mystery of the mind. And today, as you know, we're looking at the notion of the mystery of genius. Next Sunday, April 29th, the building will open at 10:30, the meeting will start at 11 promptly and close at 12, and the topic for that last Sunday in the series will be Patanjali and his yoga aphorisms. That's sure to be a really, really good topic. On Wednesday nights, we are continuing through the month of April, May, and June to do the Wednesday series of what we call the winter season study. And the text used for shared readings is by William Q. Judge, The Ocean of Theosophy. This coming Wednesday night, the building will open at 5:30. If you have anything you want to look at in terms of reference materials, of straight line theosophical study, you can use the library in the front of this hall from 5:30 to 7:30. And then promptly at 7:45, a more informal meeting will be held. And so Wednesday, April 25th, the subject is cycles. We're in chapter 14 of The Ocean of Theosophy, and the title for Wednesday night is The Earth, Ages and Cataclysms. Saturday is an example of a periodic effort put together by volunteers from the associates of the United Lodge. This coming Saturday, April 28th, there will be a symposium entitled The New Cycle of Opportunity and Challenge, because this particular presentation is being hosted by associates from the lodge in Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York City, We are expecting a larger group, if you will. So that symposium will be held across Rittenhouse Square at the Ethical Society at 1906 Rittenhouse Square. It will begin promptly at 11 a.m. It will last until 4:30 p.m. And you can pick up a descriptor for the symposium at the book table in the middle of this hall. That book table, by the way, is run by a volunteer, and it is like everything else around here. It is offered either free or low cost, no cost. You will find things that you might want for your home if you are interested in setting up a cycle of devotional reading and pondering. There are magazines and periodicals, and they are offered for your purchase before and after any one of those meetings. I'm not quite sure that they'll be available on Saturday at the symposium, but any Wednesday or Sunday, certainly you can pick up whatever you would like to have in your home. There's also a way, no cost, low cost, to get that literature off the internet, either through a website that is sponsored here in Philadelphia or one that is sponsored in places like New York, LA, or Phoenix, Arizona. All you would have to do is talk to the person at the book table, and that can all be explained to you. If you feel that these ideas have value in your life and that you would like to participate in the association or in volunteering to keep things alive and well for future generations, please feel free to speak to someone at the book table or in the library when that is open. Now, without further ado, we have a brief talk this morning on the mystery of genius, and there'll be ample time following that brief talk for discussion and Q&A, things that you are considering in your life about genius.
The Mystery of Genius. What a great title. It sounds like it was written by one of the greats, like Ellery Queen or Arthur Conan Doyle, or perhaps Agatha Christie. Certainly, when the average Jane or Joe hears the word genius, they relate names like Einstein or Mozart or Da Vinci. But how they became what is considered a genius is a subject of much debate. Were they born that way? Maybe genius runs in the family. Could it be that this is just some special talent that they were gifted by God? Or could it be the sheer product of personal work, effort, and tenacity? Perhaps the manifestation of genius is just a phenomenal accident, a prize of blind chance. If you believe in one of these reasons just given, then there is no mystery for you. But because you're here in this room, you are probably thinking that maybe, just maybe, it's something altogether different. Before we explore, let's take a look at a modern prevailing definition of genius. A genius is described as a person of great intelligence who shows an exceptional natural capacity of intellect, especially as shown in creative and original work. Geniuses exhibit strong individuality and imagination and are not only intelligent, but unique and innovative. They typically have an intelligent quotient that exceeds 140, and some of them can't navigate the daily tasks of life without instructions and support from others. A riddle wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma. thanks to Winston Churchill, we have a statement that perfectly describes the way most people think about the origin of genius. If you don't believe that genius is merely an accident, or that it is somehow based on physical causes alone, that leaves you with believing in a personal God to refer the appearance of every single individual to a special act of divine will and creative energy. Of course, there are those, including scientific and medical researchers, that when asked will tell you that genius is simply a human trait passed down from one generation to another. Some say that generations are skipped along the way. There's a professor down in Florida who says that if you give 10,000 hours to your chosen field, you'll be a genius. But for the most part, the typical response is that heredity is the answer to the origin of the genius mystery. No theosophist denies that heredity does have a role in the way you look with your mother's little turned up nose, or your father's eyes and perhaps voice. Let's not forget that heredity does give us a physical brain and body, and of course we certainly need them to exhibit our genius and to complete our human experience. Just like the invisible zeros and ones of a computer program, they must be connected to a hard drive or they can't be read or used. A musician needs an instrument, a painter her canvas. This is explained in the first fundamental proposition of the secret doctrine. It is only through a vehicle of matter that consciousness wells up as I am I, a physical basis being necessary to focus a ray of the universal mind at a certain stage of complexity. Normally, humans like you and I express a fairly wide range of talents. For most of us, our tendencies and capacities and sympathies tend to be fairly average. Our talents and such sure seem minuscule when compared to that of a genius. All geniuses appear different to us because of their amazing ability to focus tirelessly on specific tasks. Yet, paradoxically, some may not be able to tie their own shoes. Blind Tom Wiggins is such an example. Like Mozart, or in these modern times, like 3-year-old Emily Bear, and hundreds of others, they must have stepped from one musically trained life on which their heart was set directly into another. William Q. Judge wrote that the explanation of geniuses can only be met by the law of rebirth, reincarnation. The flame of genius isn't lit by an anthropomorphic God's hand, save that of one's own spirit. It is the very nature of the spiritual entity itself, of our ego, which keeps on weaving new life threads into the web of reincarnation on the loom of time, from the beginning to the ends of the great life cycle. This asserts itself stronger than in the average man through its personality, so that what we call the manifestations of genius in a person are only the more or less successful efforts of that ego to assert itself on the outward plane of its objective form. The egos of an Isaac Newton or a William Shakespeare are of the same essence and substance as the egos of an ignoramus. No ego differs from another ego in its primordial or original essence, nature. That which makes one mortal a great man and another a vulgar, silly person, as said, the quality and makeup of the physical shell or casing and the adequacy or inadequacy of brain and body to transmit and give expression to the light of the real inner man. And this suitability or unsuitability is in its turn the result of karma. Every time, in every rebirth, we get reconnected to our very own self-constructed, pre-existing, personal and collective karmic web. The lessons of this web are ongoing opportunities, steps leading to our growing self-awareness and enlightenment. Genius is living proof of the pre-existence of a spiritual thread soul. The power of the soul's innumerable life experiences focused like water through a narrow channel greatly magnifies its force. Great genius, if true and innate, Blavatsky wrote, and not merely an abnormal expansion of our human intellect, can never copy or condescend to imitate, but will ever be original, sui generis in its creative impulses and realizations. If we need to reduce or condense these few pages to one very basic statement, it would be that theosophical claims rest upon one eternal axiomatic truth, and that is, everything happens for a reason. There is no divine hand from the heavens creating geniuses. There are no accidentally created geniuses. And you don't get genius from your parents. You, dear heart, are the origin of genius. The manifestation of genius in a man or woman, as William Q. Judge said, proves an immortal ego and reincarnation in our world. And finally, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, when nature has work to be done, she creates a genius to do it. Once again, the topic for today, the mystery of genius.
Okay, I'm sure that you arrived this morning with your own considerations on the topic. Well, maybe I'm not so sure. Yeah.
Well, apparently genius does have some sort of genetic component because it says that, was it Mozart, that it ran through the family line for a few generations? But it did diminish, and then it disappeared altogether. So it's not really apparently from your parents, but perhaps those lives do run a pattern through a few generations, and at least it seems like there's a flower, an absolute. The genius is the flower, but then it withers, perhaps, but it still blooms for a while, apparently.
The whole notion of heredity and the role of a family line and the appearance of a particular degree of genius, theosophically, what would be said from the basis of the philosophy is that there is a commonality of spirit from which we all spring as soul. And then like the tip of an iceberg, a particular incarnation, a body, a brain, a personality, a set of what the East would call skandhas, in other words, tendencies, talents, interests, and aversions that will bloom in a particular incarnation. And the whole notion of heredity is that, yes, it exists. Certainly we can track chromosomes, and a medical person would be able to explain that very well. But theosophically, philosophically, we're saying that spirit precedes matter, and that the DNA is a physicality, is a tool by which spirit is expressed in the objective manifest world. So the causes, and it was Shakespeare, wasn't it, that said that the child is father to the man. So the causes set up in a particular incarnation by soul working through those tools, those physical tools, sets up effects that will come later. Now, the soul may reincarnate quickly in a particular family line until that tie is exhausted. The soul may endow that family line with a particular interest or talent or skanda. But in essence, it is said that the full bloom of genius is not limited to one aspect, and it's carried in spirit, soul, mind, and then blooms in the physicality. Yeah.
So then, for those situations where it seems like, where it's kind of easy to think, oh, well, they have that in their genes and that family, they have these tendencies in their genes, perhaps, really, perhaps, they are a group of souls who have worked along the same line, and are still working along the same line, and are born into a common family together, and it's really just an effect of what they've all been doing together, rather than the effect of, well, they have this physical body that makes them a genius.
So, yeah, in terms of reincarnation, we come into, as soul, into a particular physical form and personality, and we come into life on this objective plane with a group of folks, either by bloodline or by choice later in life, where we share certain affinities. We're attracted to the same things. We may draw folks to us that complement us in some ways. If we're fortunate, a chosen group of friends or family will align themselves in a particular line of thinking and devotion, and they'll find harmony in that expression. And also, the other thought that comes to mind is that, in addition to the genetic substance, isn't it the environment, isn't it the nurturing and what's available that also helps a soul to bloom more fully, if you will? Yeah.
Well, science and our modern society tend to view heredity and environment as the two indispensable contributors to genius or whatever aspect of our lives. But from the point of view of soul, the experience, our heredity is our environment, and we've inherited our environment from the past. There is no distinction.
It's different aspects. The nature and nurture argument that goes on pretty consistently among educators and psychologists, etc. The student of theosophy would say, well, you know, you're really splitting hairs. There is something else that explains the fact that these are physical tools. They are accoutrements that the soul draws to them in order to be all that soul might be, and learn to be in the service of others. Yeah.
All this, I think, is true. In particular, in the case of Mozart, there were no generations of musicians. His father was a hack musician, He was a teacher. He was a good teacher, a strict teacher. I think in the case of Mozart and others like him, they had this experience in previous lives. They had honed it somewhere. They needed an environment to get into that would, as you say, bring it to bloom. And that is what happened. And then it dies out.
And then it dies out. The same way as any effort, any impulse, as we concentrate on something, if we clench a fist or stare at a particular object for a very long time, we know that it takes a while for the hand to relax again and the tingling sensation to go. Or if we stare at an object for a very, very long time and then close our eyes, the object is still there until the impulse naturally is extinguished, and we can see parallels to that. Yes?
Well, not only is it a mystery as to why genius appears at a very early age, like it did in Mozart, but why it dies out in an individual as they get older. Sometimes creative genius displays itself in wonderful ways in childhood, but then as the person becomes a teenager and adult, the original creative urge becomes more average. How is that possible?
Philosophically, in terms of theosophy, we see what we call child prodigies. There are carefully documented cases where there will be a toddler or an infant who has a particular incredible genius, a musical performance, an ability to be artistic, children that can recall past lives and can do certain things based on that knowledge. And then with the documentation, you can see that after what is typically called the age of reason, around 7 years old, that early expression can begin to diminish and die out. Well, what happens is that the memories of the past life that are so vivid and so impressed in all the fibers that the soul is using and all the levels of principles that little soul is using begins to dissipate. And as the moral and ethical decisions of mind that need to activate in this current incarnation, as that begins to kick in, there's also a distraction from what was to what is and what can be. And so we see that naturally dissipate. But geniuses themselves, for instance, Thomas Edison, who as an inventive genius was able to maintain and attract a group of other geniuses, probably Lewis Latimer would be key among them, folks that came to the lab and researched together as a well-honed team and came up with all the inventions that we now so beautifully are treated by. Edison said, genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. So these little prodigies who appear to be totally inspired and totally enlightened in whatever little field it is, and we puzzle because the mystery is what the Harry's went on. Edison says, yes, the inspiration needs to be there, but there needs to be 99% work. Well, we can be pretty sure that work occurred in previous periods of activity, in previous cycles of existence. Yeah.
And that would be the answer to why genius in one direction leaves such deficiencies in others. As was mentioned in the talk, it might be a brilliant musician or inventor who can't tie their shoes or doesn't understand how to put a tie on. The mundane aspects of life that we are trained on are so secondary to that focused energy over lifetimes, that there's a sort of a lopsided development.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps when those energies dissipate as that one gets older, there's an evening out maybe in the expression.
It might be. And we might be seeing, you know, if in this lifetime we can think back to our 20s, that incredibly, some of us may still be there. I took my glasses off, I don't know. Folks that are in their 20s are in such an incredible decade because so much of their life decisions are forming and they're coming together. They're 3 times 7. They've been through the early formative period. They've come into the passions and desires and mind, and now they're beginning to bloom and set a course for the coming decades. It may very well be that those passions and desires, once so incredibly important and so aflame, are extinguishing. They've come to fruition. They've served their purpose. So this one-pointed great love of whatever it is, a physical talent, a mental talent, an artistic bent, whatever that limited expression is, has come to fruition. It's burst into flame. It gradually burns itself out. The embers begin to settle. And then you have the opportunity for more growth, as it were. Yes?
There's part of me that thinks that there's two different kinds of genius. That there's the kind that you develop through perspiration in previous lives. And through karmic developments, you can kind of access that energy in order to kind of bring that through into this world of form. But then I have this feeling that there's this other type of genius that's involved with simply clearing out space. So I think if you get very advanced and you just clear out space, you have access to not only what you have done in previous lives, but to what everybody else has. It's kind of like the Matrix, where they're like, I'm going to learn how to fly that helicopter. Wait a minute. Go search for that, and then if you have space, it could just flow in. So, I mean, I have no idea. This is just an idea, but to me, it makes sense that there might be two different types of genius.
It's quite an idea, quite an idea, and we stumble around in English, where we're talking about genius, and then we also have something affiliated called talent. So maybe some of what on this plane is really a particularized talent that has come through effort on this objective plane. All those talents, all those degrees of limited or specialized genius are what the Easterners would say, what the philosophy would say, is really that nature of booty. You know, when the talk concluded with that one phrase, you are the origin of genius. Which you would we take that as? Is it the personal man with the brain, with the physical form that does the perspiring, that has the delusions of the passions and is able in a finite, transitory, limited way to express what we're calling talent or genius, an aspect of that? Or is the you that is the heart and the original, the origin of the genius, actually the spiritual font from which we all come? The declaration that we read this morning that talks about universality, a truer realization of the self, all in capital letters. The self of one, look within, thou art Buddha, our Father who art in heaven, within the heart of each and all. Involved in that notion is the concept that there is a shared booty, there's a shared wealth of all that we can imagine in the way of wisdom and knowledge and applications, and that those who are truly wise make the effort to clear up their passions and desires and their motives and their efforts, and to open up, literally, turn within quietly to the spiritual font. And who probably we could brainstorm the greatest geniuses of all, who among us historically were said to perform miracles. It's not just one individual in history, it's many across time. Folks that are called enlightened, that are given certain titles among human beings, who are able to perform by law, with wisdom, perfected actions just as needed to help the other. So yes, there's this lower talented genius that we in our delusion try to quantify and duplicate, you know, the tiger parents and people that are urgently trying to see an expression of it. And then there's this other quieted nature that strives for something else. There was a quote of a genius of Oscar Wilde, of all people. "I put all my genius into my life. I put only my talent into my works." Seen theosophically, that's quite an expression and would echo the comment. Yeah.
Yeah, we found the last comment interesting because on the one hand, that first type of genius where there's one particular thing that an individual is brilliant about but can't function in other ways, there's a kind of imbalance there. But the other type that was described by the contributor reminds us of the statement in the philosophy that a fully evolved human being, it's not that they know everything, but that they have the capacity to know anything that they direct their consciousness to. And so the philosophy talks to that, but that comes to fuller bloom with, you know, with the Mahatma. He doesn't lose the balance, though. And he can know everything that he directs his consciousness to.
It's interesting that the word balance is used, because when we think about the Eastern concept of yoga, the balance of spirit and matter, the balance of thought and action, the centeredness, there's a concept called alaya that you might want to look into, that no matter what comes in life, that equal-mindedness, that sure-footedness of we can balance this out, we can work with this, yeah.
Earlier, an example was given about holding one's fist very tightly, and then you can feel the pins and the needles. Well, we could say that that's like a blockage of energy. And the ideas that we hold, we literally hold them, and we hold, of being less than, of being limited, of being inherently imperfect. And we get these ideas not only from religion, we get them from family, we get them from peers, we get them from advertising because they make us feel less than. So these are blockages that if we're able to flush it out, then we can access these universal principles, which are in our nature. They're there, but we've covered them up.
We've covered them up as a society, and it's almost like we move through a soup, literally a psychological soup, each day of our lives. As you say, with all of the electronic media that transmits ideas, with all of the visual ideas we get, we can't even ride a bus or a bicycle, and we see posters and billboards of so-called ideals, you know, the values of the society, or lack of values of the society, are everywhere, and it's almost like walking through quicksand. We get inundated with it if that's what we're paying attention to. If we are choosing, like many geniuses do, to lift our minds up and place them someplace else and to think originally and creatively, we can begin to rinse that literally out of our natures. Your hand's been up. Yes, sir.
That
there a difference between intelligence and genius?
Excellent question. We weigh babies when they're born. We measure how long they are. Right from the very first breath, we're quantifying human beings. And the old IQ exam, that Stanford-Binet exam, where IQ is measured, and in the talk was said that too often our society tries to measure somebody's brain capacity. But we know across time that a test can be written in such a way that particular human being could never pass it. And then on the basis of that test, that human being can be described and measured and expected and be taught, literally be brainwashed. You know, you're less than, you're more than. So that IQ process is very, very suspect now, very, very suspect. And true genius would be not how fast a brain can move from a main idea to a conclusion, not how quickly a brain can take in information and process it, not how quickly a brain can take in information and keep it for a long period of time. But true genius would reside in the soul, in the mind that is using that physical brain. And that soul, that mind, regardless if you're a man, I'm a woman, regardless of our ethnicity, regardless of where we've been, soul is one, is perfectly spiritually one and equal. And that's where genius resides, in that heart, soul, mind, not in that other mess.
So yeah. Would you say that intelligence works with the brain and genius works with the mind? And are they separate?
Oh, wow. That's a deep question. Philosophically, we are offered the ideas that we spring from one spiritual source. And if you look into, if you come in and use the reference library and look into any world religion, they will speak of an unknowable source, of a divine essence that is so beyond anything we can wrap our minds around that it's just unknowable. Emanating, radiating, springing from that, like the rays of the sunshine, come all of the other essences. And among those essences are mind, the ability to think and to create and to have a vision, and heart, not the physical heart that beats in our chests, but the compassionate, incredibly warm feeling of there is justice and there's justice for all and we're all part of that, you know, those magical concepts. And so mind and heart and spirit, we get tangled in words, but that is the eternal. And everything else about us, our brain, the lower mind and desires that work through the brain, physical body, the astral, all of that other things are like clouds, they come and go, but that sunshine of the eternal always is. Yeah.
To say it another way, there's a genius that manifests through the intelligences of the lives that make up our physical being, and there's the genius that manifests through the intelligence of our soul. So we can have on one hand individuals like Idiot Savants and Blind Tom, who obviously describe genius in a very specific area. Then you can have other individuals who also call genius like Buddha and Jesus and Krishna.
Yeah. It would be like the kaleidoscopes, where you have white light that goes into the kaleidoscope and how you turn the outside of it, the glass chips on the inside, the colored chips, will create different beautiful pictures. And life is, and as it moves through cycles of manifestation, that spirit that we can imagine is radiated into soul, and that those souls then express through all these broken ships of light and colors and potentialities. So we see the array of talents and geniuses among and between us. Yeah.
We always recall to mind the 23rd Psalm.
The Lord is my shepherd.
And in the Old Testament, there are a number of very humble supplications to something not outside of oneself, within oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And the words of the 23rd Psalm can give us courage and hope that we may indeed express. Though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we should fear no evil. Thou art with me.
The 23rd Psalm is an excellent example. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, and thou art with me. That's a perfect example of how genius is expressed. And it takes genius to recognize talent, to look within. So we can look within most any modern world religion and find hidden among and between the words the true, pure, ancient wisdom of genius. And if most of us are probably, as Westerners, we're probably very familiar with the book of Matthew and the Lord's Prayer that is frequently used in the culture. And when you look into those words, or if you look into the East, look within, thou art Buddha. Many, many Christians will be taught this morning in their services that they carry Christ in the heart within them, the Christos principle. And all those words are ways of saying one notion. If we take the word Lord, however it appears in the Judeo-Christian traditions, and think of it as law, in the East they say, desire first arose in it. Perfect compassion. What first comes out of the eternal, unknowable, is a compassionate law of cause and effect, periodicity. And that law, the law is with me. The Lord is with me. That is within each of us. And then we see that everything else seems to make a great deal of sense. It all... It all falls into place. It all becomes extremely, extremely commonsensical. Emerson wrote, "Common sense is genius dressed in its working clothes." So if we are reading the 23rd Psalm or the book of Matthew or the Gita, if we're reading the Quran, whatever the spiritual teachings are, and we are open to looking at the words, and what is Lord, what is compassionate law, what would be justice, it will all begin to flow and make sense to us. Yeah.
One law that we've observed among all geniuses is an incredibly strong will. Regardless of the degree mm-hmm. or type of intelligence which they are exhibiting, they have an indomitable will, they all do. And what is will but spirit in action?
Mm-hmm. Will is spirit in action, and we each have it. Otherwise, frankly, you and I would be cuddled at home in our beds under our blankies on a gray, kind of damp morning. It would have been a great morning to stay cuddled. But we had a thought and did a miraculous anti-gravity maneuver based on our thought, we stood up out of that bed. And regardless of what the obstacles were for each one of us, we found our ways to the room this morning, again, in a very willful way. Einstein is quoted as saying, any intelligent fool can make things bigger and more complex. And there goes the question about IQ. Intelligent fools is frequently what we see. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage, a lot of fortitude, a lot of character, a lot of will to move in the opposite direction. Yeah.
So what's being expressed is what we hear so often here, that ideas rule the world. And if we start with our children, it has been scientifically proven if you tell people over and over again they are capable of doing something that at the moment they don't seem to be, the brain actually changes and allows for that capability. Once that soul believes and understands, they have the will to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
So it begins with how we treat one another, what we tell our children, what we ourselves believe. Our cobwebs of the I can't, you never could, you never will, need to be swept willfully away so that we can begin to start thinking differently.
Mm-hmm.
What will I do today now that I understand I have all this power?
Mm-hmm. A much earlier comment about opening up to allow genius to come through. A lot of that process means being introspective, being willing to ponder the kind of self-talk that we do. You know how each of us daydreams and we allow our mind to drift from one subject to the other. And sometimes without knowing it, we're actually reproducing very, very negative images about ourselves, our use of matter, about what we're potentially able to do. And some of that is certainly an impulse from past lives. Some of it is causes that set up nature and nurture and environments in this early life. But we each have within us the potentiality to be introspective, to see what the intelligent fool, what the lower mind is doing within. Are you fast enough? Are you smart enough? Are you strong enough? Have you worked hard enough? All the kind of, you know, little lower voices that can sow cause stress and worry and anxiety, and we can begin to say, whoa, wait a minute, quiet that, stifle that, that's laughable, that's what any intelligent fool would allow. Let me turn mind to something else, to something that's uplifting and comforting and universal and serene and offers energy and offers creativity. And then things open, yeah.
So my mind was just going off again and trying to differentiate between these two types of geniuses that I was talking about. And the first type was the type of perspiration. And it seems to me that, you know, in a way, these are the souls that are not awake yet, you know, that aren't on their way home yet. And then once you kind of shift over to the other, where you just start to clear out space, you know, those are the souls who are awake and they're kind of on their way back home. So, you know, my self-righteous mind tries to, you know, find my position in that and say, oh, well, I'm more advanced, I'm awake, I'm clearing out space, and I'm better. So in reality, looking back to that other type of genius, it's like, well, they're the real pioneers. They're the ones who are kind of blindly, you know, building up more karma in order to manifest this new creativity and something that's never been performed in the world. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but this is something that just kind of came to mind.
Yeah.
You know, we think that once you're awake, you're the real pioneers, but no, maybe we're on the easy road, the way back home, people who aren't are the ones who aren't awake. And that helps me kind of, you know, not feel superior and actually have compassion.
And maybe we're really parts of a whole.
Yeah.
Maybe really the two expressions, neither one is to be attached to, but to be able to stand in the middle and to see into the possibilities of each and to assist those who are still sweating to achieve something in an external way and to appreciate and assist those who have turned in an internal way. Maybe it's the celebration of the two coming together in a harmonious, non-judgmental, sweet way of serving the greater good. Maybe that's where the symphony is created. Yeah.
There's one thing that we haven't mentioned, I think, and that is he mentioned the will.
Mm.
I think there is something like an urge. The genius has this urge to create, an urge. Mozart had to write music. He didn't think about whether he was a genius or not. Picasso had to paint. And this urge to do, I think, is a very important aspect of genius. And it's not so much a brain thing, a mental thing, it's more a heart and soul thing.
That intuitive urge, that spontaneous welling up of the right, of the sense of the right thing to do in the moment, whether it's to create a piece of art or a piece of music, or the spontaneous wisdom that has no logic to it. We watch individuals know exactly how to comfort another. And we now call that EQ, emotional quotient. The urge, when we see a situation where we see tremendous pain or poverty, and there's a sense within of, I know how to assist that. And we follow through, quietly do it, and then fade away into the wormwood. In those moments of life, we're sensing what it is to be, as the earlier speaker said, going home, of coming back to a central position of no stress, no sweat, no disease, just a perfectly human, a perfectly divine perception of how to help, when to help. And too often, we block those impulses. You know, in the Ocean, which is that collection of articles from the late 1800s, there's the lower manus, that lower mind, the busy mind that's worried about the perspiration and workaday things, and that lower mind that we try to quantify with our IQ tests. It retains all the impressions of a lifetime and sometimes strangely exhibits them and interferes with the action of the higher aspect of mind, higher manus, because at present desire and all the corresponding powers are obscured. The lower mind operating through the brain is at once altered into the shape and other characteristics of any object, mental or otherwise. So we allow all that potentiality to be distracted and distorted and placed on a finite transitory aspect, and we block the natural impulse, the natural urge to be the sanctified soul working through nature that we truly are. Our time is up. But certainly, please, those hands that were just going up, share what you have to say with a nearby friend. And if the ideas appeal to you, remember the building opens at 5:30. You can look at any of the reference materials that you want to. The Wednesday night class will be talking about cycles. and Saturday for free at the Ethical Society across the square. The door will open up at 11 o'clock and there will be a series of presentations, and you can look at the titles and see what you think. Have a great week.